try it out and just see what the students, how the students reacted to it. Mm-hmm. And the students reacted to it very favorably. As a matter of fact, I published a paper in the Journal of Chemical Education in which I even wrote a steroid by Newman projection. You've never seen a steroid look anything like this. But
do you have this reprint handy? I would like, again, any reprints that we sort of mention, I would like to attach to the tape.
See, if you take naphthalene, hydrogenated naphthalene, you
Michelin
have a cis trans ring.
Yes.
And they say, well, one is flat and one is bent. But you really see the bending much better if you look at it by a Newman projection. Mm. And yet people don't use this for naphthalene compounds or steroids. They only use it for cyclohexanes and aliphatic things. The reason why is the person who gets expert in this field of research gets so used to doing it in a certain way that he doesn't want to change it.
That's right. That's right.
And usually you don't teach in a course all these fine points of steroid chemistry.
Well, besides that publication, the proceedings of the Wayne State talk, where was the first place where you put it into print?
I think in the Journal of Chemical Education.
That was the first one. It did not appear in a JACS publication in conjunction perhaps with some other work.
Not of mine, I don't think, because I didn't do any research in this field. This was purely a teaching device.
But, of course, it was used in your book on steric effects.
And well, that appeared, I think, in 1956.
Yes.
It appeared in 1956. So all this stuff was doing in the early 50s.
I see. In other words, how well was it established through the publication in the General Chemical Education article? Did it require the book before it really took on, or was this article in J. Chemec sufficient?
No, it took time. It took time until more and more people used it in explaining the results of physical organic type stuff, rate measurements and things like that. That's where it was used mostly.
I recall in one of your one of the symposiums that were presented in your honor, I think it was the one in Cincinnati, that Kurt
Learning,
yes, gave a talk where he was retrieving from the literature the statistics and citations of your work, and I think this paper or this book was a big runaway, that no other work was published as frequently or cited as, not published, was cited as frequently as the one, the steric effects. Has this changed since that time, do you know, whether some other work has come close to the number of citations that it has received?
I was asked at one time, didn't I want to put out another edition, you know, a more recent one? And my answer to that was no, because I just didn't want to do it anymore. I thought that book had the principles involved, and as it gets implied to more and more fields, it's nothing new, really. It's just more examples of the same thing, and that will always continue. And I said, if anybody wants to do it, they have my blessing, but I haven't seen anything done.
Again, a sort of question which is awkward. In retrospect, was it an elation or disappointment being known for the Newman projection more than anything else that you have done in your long career?
Well, I think it's a miscarriage.
Well, that's what I wonder.
I myself did nothing with this. I only used it as a teaching device.
Yes. But so many times some appointment will hinge on a work and people go and count citations, you know, how what is happening to the work. And but you don't want to be known in your work just for the human projection, do you?
Frankly, if the truth be known, I don't care what I'm known for. I'm always looking for something new, not what's past.
Well, again,
I get more kick out of this new reaction I was talking to you about than the sulfuric acid
is right, right?
It's present. It's now, not 20 years ago.
Who coined the word Newman projections? I know that you did not use it in your writing. Do you recall who was the first one who gave this adjective.
It was in the book, wasn't it? What were they called, Newman projections? In the book? Elio wrote the chapter, didn't he?
No, that's what you wrote the chapter.
Effects in chemistry.
Yeah. Helios. You wrote the chapter using this projection, didn't you? It's one of your own?
No, I don't think Mel wrote a chapter on that.
Hey, this was on cyclo. I just swear I don't remember.
Let's see.
A Russian.
From Russia.
A translation.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're going to
see. But see, write the first chapter. I know I didn't write the first chapter. See who wrote the first chapter. Can you tell enough about Russian? Who that is?
Well, I think we better look into the English edition rather
Did
than.
Did Fitzer write for you, K. Fitzer?
Did Fitzer write a book?
Yeah, Fitzer. Is that Fitzer?
No, that isn't Fitzer.
No,
Pumpter.
Pumpter.
See if I can find this.
Yes, the authors are Dauben and Pitzer on the first chapter, and they do use the term projection, parenthesis, Newman, so I guess they must have been the first ones who introduced
this. John, on that symposium that you're talking about, that Kurt Loning did citation, I gave a paper, as a matter of fact, I think the first paper of the morning, in which I analyzed the Newman projection in terms of how it displays the symmetry of F theta and its derivatives. And I spent, I guess, 30 minutes explaining why I thought that this had acquired such great popularity. And I don't know whether Mel, I think I cited in doing that the situation analogous to the graphic art of Escher and the relationship to crystallography. Escher, you know, was a great graphic artist, and he used in his drawings, we're talking about how conveying the dimension of depth on a plane surface. In developing his drawings, I think that he used probably all the crystallographic space groups that are known. And crystallographers have analyzed his drawings in terms of what space groups they represent. Not that Mel is related to chemistry in the same way that Mel is related to art in the same way that Escher is related to crystallography. But I think that sometimes people can see things in a way and use them without quite recognizing that that method of representation is an expression of some kind of fundamental representative art. And in this case, the key to me wasn't a very simple concept. In a two-dimensional drawing, a plane projection drawing, the difficulty in chemistry is that without a convention for knowing what groups are in front and what groups are behind, the plane projection formula doesn't tell you that information, and therefore, in most chemistry, is useless. The beauty that Mel did in his most simplified expression was that in a plane projection formula, you knew which groups were in front and which groups were behind.
True.
And that unlocked the stereochemistry on a plane surface of a projection formula. And that's the trick to do in a representation in a planar thing. We have all kinds of devices for doing that, but those are perspective drawings to get the regular plane projection formula and still retain the knowledge of what groups are in front and which groups are in back. Really is the hinge.
I have a question that relates to it. I always admire a chemist, stereochemist in particular, who can take any molecules, whether they've seen it or took a model, and just write it three-dimensionally on a blackboard. Can you do it? I mean, just out of blue sky and take it and really just write it just as it existed. It
depends how complicated it is. Now, I have difficulty doing this. But to get back to something in one's education that might have led to this, the only thing I can think of that when I was in high school, I had a course in mechanical drawing. Have you ever had a course in mechanical drawing? Well, they teach you how to do a three-dimensional, you know, working drawing of a piece of metal with a whole board at such an angle. And, you know,
screw and a board, you know.
You look at it at one angle, and then at right angles, and then at top. In other words, you're looking at three.
Descriptive geometry.
And that was what I did. I looked at this molecule from one of those directions, and it turned out that the direction to look it at was along the axis of the two atoms.
Yeah, but the real beautiful simplicity of having solid lines indicate what was in front, and a short with a circle in behind those don't appear in the real molecule. Those don't appear in the molecule as such, and I think that the fact that you could push something against the plane and still have a memory of where it came from is key. Furthermore, and because it is, it immediately shows us how a molecule with six-fold symmetry that is easier to see than in the projection formula. Mm-hmm. That is, you can see immediately that axis that you're looking down is the six-fold axis, and you can see immediately that a twist of 60 degrees around there gives you the superimposable image. So there's hardly a better representation. And because it shows the highest symmetry easiest, it is a very effective representation.
Since you brought out this Russian translation of the book, into how many languages was the book translated, that you know of?
I didn't know it was like that until a Russian scientist came through here once years ago, and he said, "Did you know your book had been published in Russia?"
You never received any royalties?
No.
They are waiting for you.
He said to me, he says, "If I ever go to Russia, you can get the royalties."
There must be quite a sizable amount. I think you should make an inquiry that may finance a trip to the Olympics next year. And family, probably.
The Japanese, I think, also came out with it. But they did it on some kind of deal with Wiley. I think they got permission.
Well,
it wasn't in Japanese. It was in English, but it was done.
Oh, it was an Asian reprint, pirated.
Japan doesn't do that.
No, that's why I say I would be surprised.
No, Japan pays. The Russians just take your book and publish. They don't ask.
Oh no, yes, they don't ask you, but they deposit money.
Well, the Japanese did it, but they don't pay much.
Yeah. Well, that is that cheaper edition.
Yeah, those Asian edition. That's in prison in Taiwan.
I think I have a book that published in India that cost 5 cents there.
That's right. And you can buy it there, but you cannot import it in this country.
But you know, interestingly, Wiley's never wanted to come out with another edition. See, they sold all they had with another edition of it. I think because they felt there wasn't that large a demand.
Right.
But there still is a company up in Michigan.
Yeah, microfilm. Xerox now. They're owned by Xerox.
I think I got $18 this year royalty from them, because some people are still asking for. And you know, it is a strange thing. The library copies here disappear. People just swiped them. It's still a useful book, even though it's 20 odd years old. The principles are still sound.
Well, if you would write an updated edition, would you retain all the chapters and just bring it up to date, or would you delete certain chapters altogether and have new ones added?
Well, I haven't thought about it much because I just decided I wasn't going to do it. I've written two books in my life. One is this thing, because I thought there was a need for it. And the other one is that lab manual, which is absolutely unique, but not used at all.
I'm not even familiar with the lab manual. Which one is that?
Well, it has what I call my philosophy of lab teaching, which is in it for beginning students. And we've been doing that at Ohio State now for about 11 or 12 years. Sophomores can take the lab course. We have what we call an optional course, and they use my text more or less, although a lot of the experiments have changed now. But the whole principle of the course is they're given lectures on laboratory techniques, different ways of doing things, and advantages and disadvantages of each. And then they're told objectives, and they have to fulfill the objectives by their own directions. In other words, there isn't an experiment in this course where they do cookbook stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Most lab manuals, you see, they'll say, do this, do that, do that. And if you get a 70% yield, you get an A. I don't have a single experiment like that. But in every experiment, they have to count for a minimum of 90% of the starting material, which is a research aspect.
Well, how long has this been on the market?
Oh, 7 or 8 years.
It's
called an advanced organic laboratory text. I originally wrote this for the graduate students.
Yeah. And who's the publisher?
Macmillan.
Who? What did you say?
Macmillan.
Oh, Macmillan. No, because one of my colleague teachers likes that, and he sends them to a library to dig out their own procedure. And I just wonder whether he's aware that there is really a book that he could be using. So there may be a market, but we don't know it. So I would like to show it to him if you have a copy or refer him to it, because I don't remember seeing it. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I have a copy.
Yes.
But the beauty about it, I think, is that right from the beginning, it's done with research philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
The guy has to say, a student will come and say, well, how long should I heat this?
Mm-hmm.
Or what solvent should I do? We never answer.
Yes.
Say, well, what's the purpose of a solvent?
Yeah.
And then they think in terms of that. You see, it affects concentration, right?
Mm-hmm.
It affects temperature, and the polarity may affect an intermediate. It was right from the beginning you start talking about these.
Well, why do you think this has not become a popular?
It takes too much time. See, this course we give,
mm-hmm.
A student has a lab space, and he can, it's his, nobody else has it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're told if they take this course, which is optional, they must spend a minimum of 15 hours a week, which is
long.
The ordinary course is 9, and they get no extra credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of them spend more than they get to eat any meals in the lab. And then they work in pairs. In other words, we encourage students, well, we'll compare our results.
I mean, both are doing synthesis.
The same experiment. Same,
but both have to agree on the procedure, or they have a choice.
They'll agree on the experiment except for one variable.
Yes, I see.
Now they'll do it, and they'll find out what the effect of that variable is. Which is what I call a research atmosphere.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give them directions, I don't care how good they are, you're training them to be lab technicians.
Well, I think before we leave here this weekend, I would like to get a copy of every reprint that you have, because I like to deposit it together with the tape. So, and if you could attach a manual, if you have another desk copy available, I would appreciate it, getting it. I'm just speaking just for the record, really.
Yeah.
Do you want to continue?
Like all informal conversations, it's hard to segregate one thing from another, because that's not only the way humans are, but that's the way chemistry is. We really talk now about how these early studies, especially the ones on sulfuric acid work and the consequences of that, gave you a special appreciation for steric factors in organic chemistry. And what we've been discussing in some detail is the book that you edited and wrote one chapter in it? Now, many chapters?
Two
chapters in that book, Steric Effects in Organic Chemistry, I guess it was called. And I think the breadth of recognizing the breadth of the importance of steric effects in all kinds of reactions was one of the major contributions. Now, when we get to the work that you did in your own laboratory with respect to steric effects, certainly some of the most interesting work was the work that you did at what you called overcrowded molecules, and I think you touched on that a little bit in the synthesis of the dimethyl benzanthracenes and in the benzpyrenes. I wonder if you'd want to say a little bit about that follow-up of the on bent rings or bent methyl groups and the whole introduction of a new kind of optical activity in hydrocarbons.
Well, that arose from the argument about where the methyl groups were, how they were bent. So I thought, well, instead of having methyl groups, why not just have another fused ring? Because the carbon next to the previous ring spatially is the equivalent of a methyl group where the carbon-hydrogen bond is in the plane of the other ring. In other words, a methyl group has free rotation, but another fused ring doesn't have free rotation. It's frozen in that conformation in which the CH bond is in the same plane as the other ring. And if you make a molecule like that, now you're not talking about where the methyl groups are because the whole ring is involved. It turned out, if you do that with dimethylphenanthrene, which is the analog of the chrysine,
the 4,5-dimethyl,
you get a five-membered ring. But from what we had done on resolution of such compounds, it turns out that at room temperature, the racemization was so rapid that you really couldn't study the thing. So the next answer was to put another ring on. So instead of five rings, it was
how did you know that you were getting racemization?
Because we did compounds with two methyl groups. And if we worked quickly, we could see a rotation.
Yeah.
And then if you take the rotation 20 minutes later, and it's gone. So obviously there's racemizing in the machine.
But this was a hydrocarbon, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
But why would it racemize? I mean, what would be the mechanism of racemization?
Well, it was, consider 4,5-dimethylphenanthrene. Mm-hmm. And an acid group someplace else on it.
For resolution
purposes. Now, when you resolve it, let's say this methyl group is up and that one's down. But at room temperature, they flop.
Oh, I see.
You have to work quickly, And if you work quickly enough, you can see a rotation.
The energy barrier was relatively low for interval. Yes.
So I said, well, instead of methyl groups, if you have a ring, that's five rings, it turns out. Well, I said, well, to make it better, let's put six rings. Mm. And that led to the concept of trying to make hexahalocene. Yeah. And when that compound was made, that turned out to be optically stable. As a matter of fact, when you heated that compound up to racemize it, you have resolved it. When you came to a temperature high enough to racemize it, the molecule decomposed. And
say a little bit about the method of racemization. You had to worry about that too, because there weren't too many hydrocarbons that could be derivatized in a way that you could allow separation of the enantiomers, or the diastereomers.
The idea there was we couldn't have an acid group or an alcohol group. To attach an optically active function. So the concept was to make an optically active complexing agent. And that was derived from your studies on, well, you were the first to make tetranitro, didn't you?
Fluorinone.
And you see, that's a good complexing agent. And so that's symmetrical, though. So we made a compound with a bromine. So it was unsymmetrical, and we put a side chain on it to get it resolved. So we had an optically active resolving agent which owed its optical activity to an asymmetric carbon, so it wouldn't racemize. Now this thing has a different rate of formation of a complex with a D and an L isomer. And so by using that concept, we could resolve it.
You crystallize the two diastereomers, and then
in that case, no. We couldn't get a complex crystal. But what we could do is arrange the concentration of the medium so that the complex, even though it wasn't crystal, could be separated from this complex, which wasn't good, was filtered off, and what was left had an unequal amount.
I see.
Of the DNA.
You just got partial separation.
Mm-hmm. Then you could crystallize it.
Yeah, I see.
And they were stable enough at boiling benzene temperatures, so they wouldn't get any racemization. To racemize these things, you had to heat up to about 200 degrees.
No, you're talking about racemization of the hydrocarbons. Not the complexes.
Not the complexes. Yeah.
This work that you just described, was this a PhD thesis?
Yes.
Whose work are you?
Wilson Lutz made the
LUTZ, Lutz?
Yeah, Lutz. And by that, for example, we took naphthol secondary butyl ether, which has an asymmetric carbon. You try to resolve that by some method.
Mm-hmm.
You treat with this reagent, and you could do it in a half an hour because it so happens that a solid complex crystallized out immediately. You filtered it off, decompose it, and got your natural ether with a good high rotation.
Did you eventually fish out both modifications, or just one?
On the hexahelocene, you mean?
On the hexahelocene, we fished out just one, although we eventually got both.
You never had both pure enantiomers?
Yes, I think we did. I think we got them both.
Up to the same rotation.
Because what we would do would take the optical isomer of the resolving agent to get the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure we got them both out. Because one was something like plus 3,500 and the other one was minus 3,600, something like that. They had a very high rotation, which kind of surprised me at the time. I knew so little about rotation. But the reason why is interesting. You see, with most asymmetric compounds, let's say you have secondary butyl acetate. Now, in solution, you have all kinds of conformations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you're measuring is the sum of all the rotations. Suppose you had it just frozen in one conformation, mm-hmm. the rotation probably is very much higher because you're not averaging it out. Now, with these polycyclic hydrocarbons...
You mean the average rather than the sum,
yeah.
Because some of them may rotate the other
way. Yeah. But if you had it in one form, you might have one form that had a rotation of plus 40 and the other one minus 36. So what's your average? Two. Whereas with these hydrocarbons, they're so fixed that they only have one conformation. And that's part of the reason why the rotation is so high. We're only measuring, really, one conformation. Because, you see, it goes as close as it can with bond distances. They come as close as they can approach each other. They don't go further because that would take more energy. So you really have just one conformation. A little vibration, but not much.
You're not saying that in solution these are getting to be.
Yes.
You take the optical rotate. What solvent do you use generally for that?
Well,
chloroform or something?
Well, whatever solvent you have.
Are they?
Yeah, they were not very soluble, but we got
the rotation was so high.
That's right. You had to have a dilute solution.
Right.
The rotation was so high. But the point is, in solution, you really essentially have only one conformation.
There's nothing confirmation, but there are many orientations. The light is striking these in a multitude of orientations.
That might be. That's right.
But nevertheless, it's a fantastically. I think that the use again of the term overcrowded molecules at one time was more popular than it is now. I don't see the term used. Maybe I'm not reading the literature.
People have a short memory. But I'll tell you one thing we're doing now, very interesting. I thought about it for years, but I never could think of a way of accomplishing it, so I never did anything about it. And that's this. If you take a molecule like benzene, and you want to measure the rate of reaction at any one position, you make it and you do it, because it's symmetrical, and you get the same result at each spot, wouldn't you? Well, now, a man like Dewar, was interested in finance range. What are the relative reactivities at the five different spots of finance range? What he did was he brominated. And he isolated the five bromo compounds. Extremely difficult. And from the amounts of each, he said that's the relative rate of reaction, you see, at each position. Well, that's pretty crude, isn't it? And I thought it was
crude is distinguished from crummy.
Huh?
Crude is distinguished from crummy.
All right, yeah. Well, I happened to read some papers of an Englishman named Taylor who's doing the most beautiful work on aromatic electrophilic substitution that's ever been done, I think. He takes a compound like one bromonaphthalene and two bromonaphthalene, which he can get pure. He replaces the bromine with tritium via an organometallic. So now he has pure 1-tritio and pure 2-tritio. Now he's found that if you treat this with trifluoroacetic acid, every time a proton goes on the carbon with a tritium, that's the intermediate. The tritium goes off, so when you measure the rate of loss of tritium, you're measuring the rate of electrophilic substitution at that position, and that position only. So he takes the two compounds, and now he gets the relative rate alpha and beta in naphthalene, right? And he can do this very accurately, by the way.
So what's he treated with? Sulfuric acid or
no,
just
trifluoroacetic acid?
Oh, trifluoroacetic acid, sorry. Yeah.
At a certain temperature.
Yeah, yeah, so it's just proton to tritium exchange. Tritium.
Furthermore, the intermediate is as symmetrical as you can get it and is subject to as little steric effect as you can get. You take bromine, you see, you can argue, well, the rate at this position is affected by the size of bromine. You can't do that so well. You can't get anything smaller than hydrogen. Well, now, I read this work, and I immediately wrote him a letter, and I said, we would like to make some bromo compounds of, let's take the first example, 4,5-dimethylphenanthrene, put a bromine in the 9 position, and then take 2,7-dimethylphenanthrene, which has the methyl groups in equivalent positions, except there's no steric factor. And let's see what is the difference in rate of reaction at the 9 position of these two things. So we said, fine, make them. We did. You'd be surprised how much more reactive the hindered compound is than the non-hindered. And what we want to do now is to take benzanthracene, you see, which has 12 positions.
Yeah. Why is it such a big surprise, Mel, when the electrophile has to come in, you know, perpendicular to the plane of the ring?
Yeah, but the ring is flat in one case and not flat in another. And so I thought it would be faster because the ring isn't flat.
Yeah.
Well, it was I should say it was more surprising to him than it was to me.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I expected it to be faster. Yeah. But I couldn't tell you if it was 5 or 1,000.
Right, yeah.
It turned out to be about, I think it's around 4 or 5 times faster. Well, we've made him several compounds like that. But I want to go into the benzanthracene series now and take, using the old number, the 10-methylbenzanthracene and make all 11 monobromos and get their rates. And then take the 9-methyl, which is the methyl.
Injured,
And yet the whole thing is warped. And see what effect the warping has
at each position.
At each position. And nothing like this has ever been done.
I mean, this is the work that is presently going on in your laboratory?
We just got an NSF grant to do it.
And this was around the doctoral students or postdoctoral?
No, I don't have any.
So only postdoctoral.
Postdoc. Now, making these bromo compounds is a pain in the ass. It's much tougher than making methyl or chlorine or bromine compounds. But we'll have to try and
Why
do
you
it.
Choose bromo?
Because he wants the bromine because of his organometallic method.
Yes, I see. We'll replace it with tritium.
Yeah. He does that. In other words, this is cooperative research.
You're just making sending him.
We're making to him.
The exchange and rates. He does it. Exchange and rates.
Yeah, he does. He's all set up for that.
That's Taylor in England? Where in England is he located?
Sussex. He's done, he must have published 20 papers on this. It's so interesting. Because it's easy to do the work, you see. All somebody has to do is make the compounds. And the beauty of it is it gives you the rate in only that one position. So there's no complications. He's done it with financing, and he gets all these rates much better than Dewar did by just Germany.
And getting products, great quantity of products.
Yeah, he does. All he does is measure rates.
This tape is running out. I will stop it here. Mm-hmm.